Let's see now. I had a topic this morning, didn't I? A pilgrim's expectations. A pilgrim's expectations. And I want to begin with a passage from Matthew 9 and 10. Matthew 9:35, Jesus went through all the towns and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the good news of the kingdom and healing every disease and sickness. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field." And he gives the disciples a good many rather daunting previews of coming attractions. He tells about how they're not going to be accepted in every village where they go. Go to the lost sheep of Israel. You're not going to be welcomed by the Gentiles. And be on your guard against men. They will hand you over to the local council, flog you in their synagogues. On my account, you will be brought before governors and kings. Verse 19 in chapter 10, "But when they arrest you, do not worry about what to say or how to say it, as that time you will be given, at that time you will be given what to say. Brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child. Children will rebel against their parents and have them put to death. All men will hate you because of me. But he who stands firm to the end will be saved. When you are persecuted in one place, flee to another. I tell you the truth, you will not finish going through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes." Now, verse 24 should be a crucial one for all of us all the time. "A student is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master." And whenever you hear people asking these questions, these rather angry and pitiful, self-pitying questions, "Why would God do this to me?" I just want to give him this verse. Who do we think we are? "A student is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master." And who is our master? Who is our teacher? Jesus Christ himself, who was despised and rejected and reviled, and nothing that ever happens to us comes even close to the kind of treatment he got. What are your expectations as a pilgrim? Let's get very down to earth and sensible about this. "A student is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master." Verse 25, "It is enough for the student to be like his teacher, and the servant like his master." Is it enough for you? Are you prepared to receive with thanksgiving, with gladness, whatever kind of treatment God has permitted to deal with you? Is it enough? Well, we're very, very self-protecting, aren't we? Always wanting to make sure that we get what's coming to us and we don't get what we don't want coming to us. And we've got all sorts of ideas about what we should do and how we can be happy. But I remind you again of the three conditions of discipleship. Do you want to be my disciple? You don't have to be. But if you have chosen to be, and I doubt that you would have bothered to come to a seminar like this unless you came without any idea what you were going to get. But presumably, all of us here would say, "Well, yes, I do want to be a disciple. I want to follow Jesus Christ." So Jesus said, there are three conditions. Number one, give up your right to yourself. Deny yourself. Now, that's a very scary word, isn't it, today? We get all twitchy and worried about, "Oh, but I don't want to be in denial." Well, you know, forget about these psychological terms. If you're going to follow Jesus Christ, you're going to have to be in denial of a whole lot of stuff. That's what it says. Deny yourself. Abandon yourself. It is self-abnegation, self-abandonment, total relinquishment of who I am and what I think I ought to be and what I should receive and how God treat me and all that. That's number one of the conditions of discipleship. Number two is the taking up of the cross. In what form, ladies, do you expect the cross of Jesus Christ to be presented to you? Do you think God's going to give you something dramatic and heroic to do someday? Oh, well, those five men, you know, that was wonderful what God gave them to do and what a tremendous influence they've had. But you know what the taking up of the cross is for most of us? Well, I'll read you one wise man's definition. It is no great action done once for all. It consists in the continual daily practice of small duties which are distasteful to us. How about that? The taking up of the cross is no great action done once for all, but the continual practice of small duties which are distasteful to us. Now, there are a good many duties that the Lord gives us which we enjoy, we love, and we consider this is a ministry that God has given me, such a wonderful ministry. But very seldom do you think about the cleaning of the toilet as a ministry. And I remember that there was a commercial that came on TV that used to just infuriate me. It was this woman saying, "If there's one job I hate, it's cleaning toilets. You know what? I don't clean them anymore." Well, but then, of course, she goes on to tell you about this product that all you need to do is stick it in the tank and it'll do the cleaning for you. It's blue stuff. And I'm not here to tell you don't use the blue stuff. There's nothing about that. But it was the attitude and the tone of voice. "If there's one job I hate..." Well, I don't know what job you hate, but I love housework. I love cleaning toilets because, you know what? I know exactly what to do. I know exactly how long it's going to take me. And I know what the results are going to be. When I sit down to write a book, I don't know any of those things. I don't know how long it's going to take me. I don't know how to do it. And I don't know what the results are going to be. So there are a whole lot of things which are distasteful in the sense of being much more difficult than other things. But have you ever thought of those little things in your life, that person you can hardly stand and you wish she were not in your church, and how did we ever get this woman on our committee and what's she doing here? Distasteful things. But the taking up of the cross is the continual practice of accepting those things which are distasteful to us. Another writer said, "How shalt thou bear the cross that now so dread a weight appears? Keep quietly to God and think upon the eternal years." A.W. Tozer was a very, very wise man. And this little leaflet that I have is one that I have worn out several copies of it, because he talks about the fact that exposition must have application. And it's wonderful to see all you people with notebooks and scribbling away, and you're taking down a lot of good stuff. But the rubber meets the road when there's application of whatever it is that you're taking down. What kind of a difference is it going to make it in your life after you leave this wonderful place? And he says, by far the greater proportion of the book, speaking of the Bible, is devoted to an urgent effort to persuade people to alter their ways and bring their lives into harmony with the will of God as set forth in its pages. Theological truth is useless until it is obeyed. And you can talk and you can sing and you can pray a whole lot about discipleship, pilgrimage, following Jesus Christ, but obedience is the test, isn't it? Obedience in your life, in the secret place where nobody's looking. So let's think now a little bit about this business of a disciple's expectations. It means discipline. The word disciple is related to exactly the same Latin root as discipline. So don't call yourself a disciple of Jesus Christ unless you are making an earnest and daily conscious effort to be disciplined in every area of your life. your time, your work, your possessions, your mind, your body, the emotions. How many of you have ever worked very hard on the discipline of your emotions? Oh, well, they're just things that happen. You know, I'm a very emotional person. Well, God has given us two faculties. One is emotion and one is will. Does your life revolve around your emotions, or is it governed by a will? And it is my will that is to govern my emotions. It doesn't make any difference how bad I might feel. You know, maybe you're one of these people that has PMS. Well, in my day, there was never any such thing as PMS. We were not allowed to have anything like that. We were not allowed to be nasty at a certain period of the month because nobody had ever heard of it. Well, now that we've heard of it, we give ourselves permission to be snotty. I mean, I'm just giving you one tiny possibility. There might be three people here that would understand what I'm talking about. Now, what is discipline? Well, Webster's Dictionary said it is training which corrects, molds, strengthens, perfects. Discipline is training which corrects, molds, strengthens, and perfects. My emotions are ungovernable. When people say, oh, well, I just go by my feelings. I can't imagine a more risky way to run your life than to go by your feelings, because you might feel one way at 7 o'clock in the morning, a very different way by 10:30. And if everything depends on how you're feeling about things, you're in big trouble, and everybody that has to live with you is in worse trouble. So you bring your will under the authority of Jesus Christ, and you will to do his will. Jesus said, he that willeth to do his will shall know the doctrine. Will you will to do his will? So let's not get soupy about our emotions. Training which corrects, molds, strengthens, and perfects. Control is gained by enforcing obedience or order, for example, in school or in the army. There's no question about discipline. I went to a public school, and in the sixth grade, we had a woman who was probably one of the finest teachers that I ever had anywhere. She was just an ordinary sixth grade public school teacher. But you know what? She could completely control 42 kids with her eyes. And Miss Evanson, when she looked at us, we were galvanized into action. There was never any such thing as anybody standing up or speaking out of turn. I've read that in the New York City public schools, the teachers spend 80% of the time saying, shut up and sit down. Now, of course, in my day, we wouldn't have dreamed of speaking without raising our hand first. We wouldn't have dreamed of getting out of our seats without being given permission. So it is discipline is control gained by enforcing obedience or order. It is orderliness gained by self-control. What's the state of the top drawer of your dresser? What is the state of your purse? What is the state of the trunk of your car? You don't want me going into your house and opening the closets, do you? Well, of course, it's none of my business. But I do want every area of my life to be ordered, because I want to be a true and honest, faithful disciple of Jesus Christ. The verb of discipline, to discipline, means to educate, to develop by instruction or exercise, to order and correct the operation of, for example, of talents or of faculties. You have to order and correct the operation of your faculties, to render effective by restraint, to chastise, to bring under control. And I like old Vance Havner's definition of spanking. The posterior application of superior force. My mother's method of bringing discipline was to have a little switch over the door of every room in the house. About 18 inches long, and we knew that that little switch was up there, and it was very seldom that my mother ever had to use it, because all she had to do was raise her eyes to the top of the door. We were galvanized into action like that. Now we hear endless, absolute rubbish on the TV and in the books and the newspapers and everything about the ways in which children should be raised. And there's a man named John Bradshaw. We've seen him a couple of times, and I've never heard such a load of nonsense in my life. But this is a sample. He says, if my daughter can say no to me, she will be able to say no to anyone. If she can say no to me in safety, she would be able to say no to those who crowd her or who violate her boundaries. And I had never heard this word boundaries until I heard John Bradshaw. And now everybody's talking about boundaries, including all sorts of Christian writers. Boundaries, you know, we're talking about a four-year-old who can set boundaries. The possibility that the greatest threat to her daughter's boundaries is likely to go unrecognized by the daughter, and that the child's first defense against that threat should come in the form of a large no from her mother, obviously goes unrecognized by the mother herself. She assumes that the child knows as much as she does. So this commentator who is quoting John Bradshaw, he says, when your child first says no to you, advises television child-raising expert John Bradshaw, this is a moment to celebrate. Bradshaw said, a time to bring out the party hats. She's establishing limits and boundaries for herself. And I don't think you and I have any right to establish boundaries for ourselves. My boundaries are established for me by Jesus Christ. Now, I'm not finished. She is asserting her sense of self. She is saying, I am me. Indeed, she is, says this commentator. So was young Mandan when he shot down his mother and stepfather, and then his two little sisters quavering in terror in the back seat of the family car. And that's the kind of thing that we're hearing about, isn't it? Almost every week we hear some horror story because of the boundaries that the parents did not set for the child, and the child is now permitted to do all of these things. So what we're talking about is the expectations of a pilgrim. What are these expectations? In that chapter, those chapters of Matthew 9 and 10, we find Jesus speaking to them about the good news, about compassion, authority, the message, which is the kingdom of heaven, healing the sick, raising the dead. But you are going out as sheep in the midst of wolves, serpents versus doves. You are doves in the face of serpents. You will be arrested and flogged. Brother will betray brother. All will hate you. Pupil, teacher, servant, master, do not be afraid of those who kill the body. You're worth more than many sparrows. And I send you out to bring not peace, but a sword. Gain out of loss, and don't worry about the rewards. I, from time to time, have the opportunity to speak with young people who are planning to go out for perhaps a summer mission trip. And there seem to be thousands of these. So when I'm asked to talk to them, I give them this verse, Matthew 10:25. It is enough for the servant to be as his Lord. You are undoubtedly going to be encountering some things which go diametrically across your preferences. There will be things that you don't like about this foreign country that you're going to and these strange people with such a stupid language and all that. It is enough for the servant that he be as his Lord. In Nehemiah, we have the story of the building of the wall. It's amazing to think of the people who helped build that wall. Well, you would certainly think of masons and contractors and people who know how to handle stone and wood. But we read that a goldsmith and a perfume maker helped to rebuild the wall. What does that say to you? If you were a goldsmith and a perfume maker, you wouldn't want to mess around with concrete, cement, or whatever it was they were building the wall with, would you? But this is just an indication that it doesn't make any difference what you think your particular talent is. God may give you something utterly different to do. And you may go through years and decades of your life in which what you thought was God's holy gift to you has absolutely no area for use. And God is asking you to do something different. A disciple's expectations, a pilgrim's expectations. I want to read a quotation here from George MacDonald in his book called What's Mine's Mine. Were it not for suffering, millions of human beings would never develop an atom of affection. It is folly to conclude that a thing ought not to be done because it hurts. There are powers to be born, creations to be perfected, sinners to be redeemed, all through the ministry of pain, that could be born, perfected, and redeemed in no other way. Now get that principle in your head, the ministry of pain. It is God's loving kindness that allows you to experience pain, because there are powers to be born. There are creations to be perfected, sinners to be redeemed, all through the ministry of pain that could be born, perfected, and redeemed in no other way. So God has a whole lot of things up his sleeve when he tells you, do you want to be my disciple? And he has given us quite a few previews of coming attractions, but at the same time, he has not told us exactly how they are going to apply to your particular case. And all of us, I'm sure, have had many experiences where things happened quite contrarily to what we hoped and what we supposed. In fact, we probably don't get through one whole day when everything goes perfectly according to our schedule of things. But the Lord is teaching us discipleship. From this passage in Matthew 10:25 and also Luke 17:10. Give you that one. I thought I had put a marker in here. He says, this is one of the ones that I think we should all copy out on a card and put on, over the refrigerator or the sink or something. You also, when you have done everything you were told to do, should say, we are unworthy servants. We have only done our duty. We are unprofitable servants, says the King James Version. We have only done that which was our duty to do. So let's not swell with pride thinking, well, I really did a great job on this. No. When you have done everything, Jesus says, you were told, everything that you were told to do, you should say, we are unworthy servants. We have only done our duty. Now, what's that going to do to your, quote, self-esteem? Another buzzword we hear all the time. You've got to build up your self-esteem. I get dozens and dozens of letters through my radio program from people who tell me that they have a big problem with their self-esteem, with building up their self-esteem. What do you think they're going to get from me by way of a reply? So I have made a list here of five things that a disciple or a pilgrim should expect. A pilgrim's expectations, very likely the difficulties. Now, this is so applicable to every life, but particularly applicable when we think that we're going to be serving the Lord in some particular and perhaps noticeable way. We're going to find out that the attrition rate is rather high. Attrition meaning people fall by the wayside. When Jim Elliott and I first went to Ecuador, it was in April of 1952 that I got there. Jim was there earlier than that. But we were both studying Spanish at the same time in the city of Quito. And during those 6 months, 20 missionaries left the field. Now, Ecuador is a pretty small country. And Jim and I were really shattered we could not understand why anybody that was committing themselves to be a missionary would ever leave the field. And here were 20 people. Of course, it was none of our business to find out why and what their reasons were. And usually the reasons are either because of the children's education or because somebody's sick. There are always those two very legitimate excuses, and nobody can find out whether that's really the story or not. But over the years, as I saw what happened in missionary life, I came to the conclusion that the pilgrims' expectations were unreasonable, and they had never really thought of how hard and how sacrificial this particular kind of life might be. They had never made an absolute surrender. This is the first thing. They had not made a total surrender to Jesus Christ at the foot of the cross. That's where you have to start. You have to start at the foot of the cross, as Jesus clearly said. Do you want to be my disciple? Number two, sounds like almost exactly the same thing, little understanding of the cross. I don't hear much nowadays about the cross of Jesus Christ. There are thousands of pastors and preachers and television personalities that are doing their thing, but to me it seems to be very few that lift high the cross. And I would, if you ever want to pray for Elizabeth Elliot, please pray that I may never remove myself from that position. The foot of the cross is where we belong, and pray that God will enable me faithfully to lift high that cross. Little understanding of the cross. The cross means suffering. It means giving up your right to yourself. It means accepting that terrible situation that you can't do anything about. It means being nice to that kind, to that miserable neighbor who has done you in, perhaps. It means acceptance of the fact that your husband's partner has embezzled all the funds and you now are destitute. All sorts of things could happen. But let's not be surprised, because what was the cross about? Third, unwillingness to submit to authority. And I think that that was very obvious on the mission field. Far too many missionaries, although they had technically authority over them in the form of the mission board that sent them out, they felt that the mission board was sitting back there in New York or Chicago and really didn't have any idea of what really was going on down there in the jungle. And so they just went ahead and did their own thing. And there's no point in putting yourself under the authority of Jesus Christ if Jesus Christ has put you under the authority of some human being. We are fallible, of course, but all of us in various ways have to submit to authority. We certainly submit to the traffic laws, don't we? We have to submit to the IRS. We don't have any choices about these things. Number four, dissatisfaction with the job. The living quarters are not acceptable. Your fellow workers turn out to be bums. The sheep that you thought were so cute and so sweet turn into wolves. Number five is disappointment with the results. And it is absolutely necessary that we experience some deep heart wound if we are going to follow Jesus Christ all the way. There will be deep heart wounds. Don't be surprised. Jesus said, think it not strange when the fiery trial, because of the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened. It happens to conform us into this image of his son. disappointment with the results. And you can put down Matthew 10, 38 and 39. Anyone who does not accept the cross is going to experience disappointment. Think of Jesus' experience with his disciples. He prayed all night that his Father would show him who he was to have as his disciples. And of course we know that that whole night of prayer ended up with 12 disciples, among whom was Judas. Disappointment with the results. But of course Jesus' response to all of these things would be perfect, not like us. So a pilgrim's expectations should respond, we should respond as pilgrims in this way to the five things that I have just given you. Number one, it is not my will, but thine be done. That is the corollary to the absolute surrender never having been made. In order to corrupt that, we say, not my will, but thine be done. Number two, which was little understanding of the cross, now the corollary is we are called to suffer. There's nothing unusual about that. We're all called to suffer, you in one way, I in another. Number three, we all have been placed under authority, which means radical limitations. We wives are under the authority of our husbands, which means radical limitations. Doesn't make any difference how long in advance of the marriage you knew this person. You had absolutely no idea what was in store for you when you actually said, I do. You thought you knew, and maybe you knew the person for 6 years or 10 years, and you just thought he was the most wonderful man in the whole wide world, and he, of course, thought you were the most wonderful woman in the whole wide world, and about 24 hours later, you find out that there were some surprise packages. You thought this man was a prize package, but he turns out to be a surprise package. Now, ladies, you're looking at a woman who has had three husbands. As far as I know, I still have number three. I have had to learn the authority of each of those three men who were very, very different. You cannot imagine how different Jim Elliot was from Addison Leach and how different Addison Leach was from Lars Grin. And the Lord gave me a very short time with Jim, 27 months. He gave me almost four and a half years with Addison Leach, but Lars and I have been married. It'll be 22 years in December. Now, I am placed under authority, and that means radical limitations. That's just one area. Now, you single women, you may be just chortling, thinking, well, thank God I don't have to go through all that kind of stuff. But, of course, most of you single women there are thinking, I would give anything in the world to have a man like Lars Grant. Number four. The corollary of the other number four. I am given an assigned portion. God apportions exactly what is best for me. Number five, the results are God's business. The results are God's business. And that's a great lesson which I learned through the story that I told you last night about the loss of my language material. It was the great principle that obedience is my job, but the results of that obedience are God's job. And just within the last couple of days, I have had conversations with several people who were very, very angry with God because of something he did to them. A girl came bounding up to me one time after I'd spoken, and she said, Mrs. Elliot, she said, I don't know, maybe this is just a really stupid question, but I just want to know, I don't know how to say this. handle the things that God did to you? And I said, what do you mean God did to me? Well, I mean, like, you know, he took away two husbands and just all that stuff that happened in the jungle and all that kind of stuff. Well, I mean, it really scares me when I hear you talk about that, because I want to do the will of God, but I don't want the will of God to be that hard. Well, I said to her, you know, God never did anything to me. It wasn't for me. My dentist said that to me one time. When I was about to leave, I said, well, what are you going to do to me next? And he said, not to, for. And that's exactly the way. It's so simple, isn't it? God is not doing anything to you that isn't for you. The results are God's business. It is enough for the pilgrim to be as his master. A pilgrim's expectations. Now, I have some questions. Whenever we have question and answer time, which I always enjoy doing when there's opportunity to do so, I would like to start with these questions, asking you these questions. I don't do this normally as a rule, but I have put these down in my notebook because these are all ways in which I am schooling myself, reminding myself constantly. I can't be dishing this out to other people until I am dishing it out to myself. So the first question is, are you willing, and I've got four things under this, are you willing to understand? And sometimes we'd prefer not to have to understand things too much because it's too hard. I don't know why it has to be so hard. Well, in Psalm 131, the psalmist says, my heart is not proud, O Lord, my eyes are not haughty. I do not concern myself with great matters or things too wonderful for me. But I have stilled and quietened my soul like a weaned child with its mother. Are you willing, number one, to understand? Number two, to rearrange your life. There's probably some very necessary rearrangement that needs to go on in some of your lives. Physical rearrangement of your house, the rearrangement of your relationship with your husband, the rearrangement of your relationship with your children, your neighbors, your fellow church members. Number three, to be healed. Are you willing to be healed? Now that may sound like a very strange question, but remember the man at the pool of Bethesda? That's exactly what Jesus asked him. Seems like a strange question to ask a man that's been there 38 years, hoping to be able to be put down into the healing water. But Jesus' first question was, do you want to be healed? And we can get so comfortable in being the object of pity. You know, self-pity is satanic. Number four, are you willing to lose your life? Physically, literally, spiritually, or in any other way? Next set of questions. Do you want solutions or do you want holiness? Very often, we want the solutions. You know, we bang away on God's door. Lord, please do something. Get me out of this. Change that person. Which is most important to you, solutions or holiness? And it may very well be that this particular very difficult situation is the route to holiness, R-O-U-T-E. Second, do you want safety or do you want to know Christ? Do you want answers or do you want orders? Do you want the light of Christ or the light of your own logic, which is darkness? Someone has said, he who insists on hearing God himself shows that what he really desires is not to believe, but to know. Not to obey, but to react to his own experience. And sometimes we want to hear God speak to us personally when God really wants to speak to us through somebody else. Some wise, godly person that God has assigned to speak to you about something. And right away, the self rises up in you with fury. Well, who does she think she is to be telling me something like this? What business is it of hers? It may very well be a business which has been assigned by God. We have a lot of questions as to how God is going to do something. Well, how in the world do you think God's ever going to work this thing out? Questions as to how God will do a thing, spring from a passion for the fruit of the tree of knowledge and not from the fruit of the tree of life. I'll read that again. This is not original with me, but unfortunately I don't have the source. Questions as to how God will do a thing spring from a passion for the fruit of the tree of knowledge. And you know what that tree was, the one in the Garden of Eden, which Eve decided they had to have. God was cheating them of something that was very good and wonderful and necessary in their lives, and so they declared their independence. That's what it was. It was a declaration of independence. We don't need God. He's trying to cheat us of the one thing in the world that's going to make us happy. And so they took of the fruit of the tree of knowledge and not the fruit of the tree of life. It is spiritual lust. I must have it now. A pilgrim has no idea what tomorrow holds. All he's doing is walking one step at a time with the Savior. Tomorrow is not our business, ladies. Yesterday is gone. We have today, this present moment. This has been one of the most simplifying, calming, and instructive principles in my life. The sacrament of this present moment. And it is here that the Lord wants to teach us and to make pilgrims and true disciples of us. Spiritual lust says, I must have it now. Is I demand an answer from God instead of seeking him who is the answer. All I need to know is he is my Savior. He is my Lord. And he speaks to me with such compassion and such earnest hope, if I may say, that Jesus actually hopes that we will receive him, follow him, love him. Do you want to be his disciple? Do you want to be a pilgrim? May God help you.